On Commerce to order. We're now meeting on Wednesday, the 21st. This is our afternoon meeting as compared to those who were with us this morning at 7:30. And for those who are here, thank you for traveling 7:30 Monday morning and for committee members for getting there. A couple housekeeping items. We have a couple bills that were scheduled for a work session today, 2891, 2892. Those will not be in work session today. They will be scheduled between now and next Wednesday, so I'm not sure. I have to check on schedules for amendments and such, so it could be either this coming Wednesday in the afternoon or the following Wednesday, the 30th. With that said, anything else in housekeeping?
I think that's it, Mr. Chair.
All right, so I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 3484. And Joel? Why don't you go ahead and come on up, too. And Representative Bonamici?
No, I didn't. Thank you, Chair.
I'm going to let you get started, and I'll just bring Joel up since he's also on here. I have no one else that's scheduled at this time.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm Suzanne Bonamici, State Representative for House District 34 in Washington County, and I'm here to tell you briefly about House Bill 3484, which passed unanimously from the House Committee on Consumer Protection and unanimously on the floor of the House, 59 aye votes and no votes. This bill basically does two things. It changes the way the Oregon Insurance Division assesses fee and on life insurance and annuities. Currently, and I'll let Mr. Ario explain the details, but currently the assessment is made only on life insurance, and this will expand the assessment to also include annuities to more fairly allocate the fees that the insurance division collects. And part two, and I want to explain that this bill was jointly requested by the Oregon Insurance Division and the American Council of Life Insurers. Part two will benefit small businesses because it will reduce the minimum group size from 10 to 2 for purposes of obtaining group insurance coverage, and that will make a lower group employee benefit premiums available to small businesses. So this is a win-win bill. I encourage your support, and I ask you to send this bill to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
And Representative, not knowing what your schedule is, I don't know if you want to stay here while Joel gives presentation. If not, we'll give you questions if there are any.
Thank you, Senator. I won't be able to stay because I'm in the middle of another committee.
Okay.
So if
any
you have
questions?
Any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have a dash one amendments in our package. Is that yours, or if you speak to those, please?
That I don't have the. Sorry, I didn't get the amendments, but it's my understanding it's to insert an emergency clause.
Well, there already is an emergency clause.
It actually deletes implementation. It deletes the phased-in implementation dates, and I think.
Thank you. I'll let Mr.
Ario
address that. I have not seen
that. Mr. Chair, Senator Barr, I can speak to that briefly. The bill does have an emergency clause on it, but it also had a section. I'm sorry, for the record, Joel Ario, Administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. The bill already had an emergency clause in Section 4, but Section 3 had a phased-in implementation of the different parts of the bill. And when we looked at the part, particularly dealing with annuities, it was an unworkable phase-in. And then we looked at the other part of the bill, which phased in the other changes that Representative Bonamici mentioned, and determined that both of those would be better off being implemented immediately, too, because they don't require any rulemaking or any changes. They're simply new opportunities for purchasers of insurance, and so we simply the amendments proposed to delete Section 3 of the bill, and the whole bill would take effect upon signing by the governor.
Any other questions for the representative? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
All right. Joel, you're on the record. Why don't you go ahead and give us the rest of your testimony, and we'll take additional questions at that time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Bonamici summarized the bill well, and so I'll just be very brief here. The first part of the bill having to do with assessing annuities, the way our funding works, it's all dedicated funding, and about a third of that funding comes through an assessment process where we look at our workload each year and then assess the three major industry sectors. Health insurance is one, property and casualty is two, and life insurance and annuities is number three. And each of them gets assessed based on what portion of our workload is going to each of those three sectors on a year-by-year basis. The problem has been within the life and annuities section, because when we first put this into effect in the 80s, annuities were a very small part of the market. They were exempted from the assessment process within that life and annuity sector. Today, annuities make up about 65% of the overall life and annuity premium. So what our proposal does is simply allows us to assess for that sector against all premium life and annuity premium. It does not change the amount of money that we assess. It does not change the amount that the life and annuity industry contributes. It simply spreads it more broadly across all of that premium. I think you have a letter from the industry supportive of this as well, because most companies sell both life and annuities. So for most companies, it's basically a wash as well, but it's just a fair way to assess. And so that's the proposal in that area, and that's in Section 2 of the bill. Then as Senator Bonamici, Representative Bonamici said, the other two sections of the bill simply are business friendly in that they allow insurers to sell group policies at to a smaller group than right now. You need to have 9 or 10 in your group in order to purchase certain group policies, and this allows group policies to be sold to groups down to the size of 2. That's something that can now be done by the insurance industry because of better underwriting practices. And then the other part of the bill, probably even more important, under federal pension law, it is now possible for someone who leaves an employer to continue to contribute to the employer-based IRA as an individual. But our law doesn't allow it. Our law allows only employer contributions, and so this would conform Oregon statutes to what's allowed under federal law and allow individuals leaving an employment situation to be able to continue to contribute to their IRAs. As Representative Bonamici said, this was a unanimous vote in the House and supported by the industry, consumer groups, and it was supported by us too. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any additional questions?
Joel, thank you. Senator, where in the bill is a piece about the IRAs?
Line 32. Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, if you look down in subsection 4 of section 2 of the bill, okay, the premium for the policy must be paid from the funds of the group policyholder or from funds contributed by persons insured under the policy or from both sources. The previous law only allowed the person contracting for the group policy, so the employer, to contribute funds.
Okay, then different question, Mr. Chair.
You bet.
Under Section 3, which is being deleted by a dash one amendment, it's only applying to policies issued on or after the effective date. If you take that out, is it still going to be only on or after the effective date? The effective date being immediately, which is what it said anyway, but if you don't have that language in there, you're not going to go back and charge annuities for stuff that's already happened, I trust.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, very good question. The way the assessment works in other lines and the way we're proposing it work here is that each year, whatever premium is collected on annuities in effect that year would be assessed. Under the original language, which is just a technical mistake, the annuities that were in effect in a given year couldn't be assessed unless they had been initially bought after the effective date of this act. So this simply allows us to assess the annuity premium on a year-to-year basis without reference to what year the annuity was originally purchased in.
Any other questions? Senator Gordley.
Thank you. Mr. Ario, you referenced a letter from the industry, which I don't have in my file.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, then apparently that letter hasn't made its way here yet. I was assured by Mr. Mangan that he would have that letter, and we did have one on the House side. I know he is traveling today, so he couldn't be here.
Okay. Any other questions? Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on House Bill 3484? Not seeing anyone, we'll close the public hearing on 3484. And unless there's heartburn by anyone, I'm going to go ahead and move this into a work session. House Bill 3484, proper motion would be adopting the dash ones.
Mr. Chair, with the dash one amendments to House Bill 3484.
Senator Beyer moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 3484. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Chair, move House Bill 3484 as amended before with the due path recommendation.
Senator Barr moves House Bill 3484 as amended with the dash ones to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And do I have a volunteer who would like to carry this one? I will carry this one then. I will volunteer myself, only knowing that someone else gets to volunteer the next time. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 3484. And we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2224. And Joel, if you'll come back up. And Bill, son, is it Hugh?
Oh. Sandy.
Yes, sir. Come on in. Come on up, sir.
2224?
Yes, 2224.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again for the record, Joel Ariel, Administrator of the Insurance Division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Here today to support House Bill 2224. It's one of the pre-session bills filed by our department, and it deals with one of the more important consumer protection functions that we perform within the department, which is to look at the insurance contracts. Those are the actual policies that you purchase when you buy insurance, and ensure that they meet basic consumer protection standards. Anyone who's ever tried to look at their own policy and understand all the detail appreciates the importance of having some kind of review process that ensures those contracts are compliant with law and fair to the consumer. And we do that review in almost every line of insurance, and it makes sense for us to do a state-by-state review in most lines of insurance. The line of insurance that Bill worked in, health insurance, and as well as auto insurance, homeowner insurance, because these are policies that differ state-by-state. When you move from one state to another state, you have to surrender your old policy and pick up a new one. There are unique features of each of those policies based on the kinds of risks they insure, the delivery systems within the state, and so forth. So for all of those lines, state-by-state review makes a lot of sense. There are questions, though, about the efficiency of the process when we get to life and annuity and disability policies, because those are insurance products that don't differ state by state. If I bought life insurance in Massachusetts 20 years ago and moved to Oregon, I can keep that life insurance product. The price doesn't even change state by state. And so there have been issues of whether it makes sense, both on efficiency and on, frankly, consumer protection grounds as well, to have each state conducting its own separate reviews. There are now 30 states who've addressed that problem through a concept called the Interstate Compact. They have come together and passed laws in each of those 30 states that put them into one national interstate compact, so it's a one-stop shopping kind of deal for product filings and approval. And if a product, a life annuity or a disability policy, is approved through that compact process, it is then good to go in those 30 states that are part of the compact. We have been watching the compact very closely. It has a lot of merits in terms of consumer protection and in terms of efficiency. The problem for us, though, and why we're not bringing you a bill today to fully join the compact, is that it is still a new compact. It only went into effect in January of this year, because the nature of that compact was, until a majority of states had joined it, it didn't make sense to create it. So the threshold was crossed last year. The compact was created, and as you'll see in the fact sheet behind my testimony, it is actively engaged in approving initial standards and starting to do business. In that context, we looked at what would be a way to move forward towards the compact without fully joining it, because we don't yet know whether the compact standards are going to be good consumer protection standards. Probably they will, but we don't know that for sure. So what we've proposed here is essentially a way of piggybacking off of the compact. What this bill would allow us to do is look at the compact product by product, and where the standards that the compact adopts and the review process that it applies to those standards serves consumer protection at least as well as the Oregon process does. We could, by rule, so it would be a public process to determine whether the consumer protection was there, but where it was, we could, by rule, adopt the compact standards, and then for products in those product categories. If they were approved by the compact, they would be approved here without further review. It's an efficiency process for us. And then the other reason why it's particularly important to me is in my 10 years with the insurance division, I'm proud of the fact that we've not had to increase our staff. We've been in the low 90s in terms of FTEs for all of that period. We've been able to accomplish that because we've been able to shift resources as circumstances change into the most important consumer protection priorities. And with a bill like this, assuming that some of the standards can be adopted as good consumer protection standards, we would then be able to shift resources into areas where the most important consumer protection issues are. And if you look at the life and annuity area today, there are an increasing number of products out there, and we think that's good. But the products ought to be approved. I talked to one of your fellow senators for several times in the last year about a particular product that he really wanted to purchase for his retirement portfolio, and it wasn't available to us because we were doing a careful review process on it. That product made sense for him, but that very product that he wanted, one of the reasons we were doing a careful review was because it wasn't necessarily going to be appropriate for some other people within the state. And what I would like to be able to do is shift our resources from that front-end product review where the consumer protection is met into suitability, looking at the issue of whether the life and annuity products that are approved are actually being sold to people in a suitable way, particularly senior citizens are oftentimes victimized in the life and annuity area. You had a bill, Senate Bill 257, I believe, in front of this committee, which dealt with that kind of issue. And so another important feature of this bill from our perspective is it allows us to redirect resources to an area that is a higher consumer protection standard, again, as long as the compact is an effective consumer protection vehicle itself. So with that, we'd urge your support of House Bill 2224.
Any questions? All right, thank you.
All right. Mr. Chairman and members of committee, my name is Bill Sandu, and I have given you the written testimony. I believe you have the copies. I would like to read that statement, then I'll be more than happy to answer your questions. My name is Bill Sandu, and I'm a retired rates and forms analyst with more than 16 years' experience of service with the Insurance Division of the Department of Consumer and Business Services of State of Oregon.
Mr. Sandu, we do have your written testimony, and
okay,
we will read it. What we'd like for you to do, if you could just summarize, we have a number of other bills that we have to hear today.
But I raised these questions,
okay,
Your Honor, in the House Committee, and I did not receive any response from the Insurance Division. Was not able to. And I'm wondering if they can respond to any of those questions I'm raising regarding this bill. Are they able to answer those to your justification that this bill needs to be passed? I strongly believe that the authority of approval of these very important forms, such as annuity and disability, should be kept in the insurance division, not given to somebody who's located 3,000 miles away, because you have no control over that. I realize that we may check. On the second page, the question that I raised, they were not raised when I testified to the House Committee, sir. And I would like to ask Insurance Division to also respond to those questions. If the Insurance Division can answer to your satisfaction those answers, I would be willing to consider my opposition. But right now, I strongly feel that the authority of approval of these forms, very important forms, should be kept in the state of Oregon. Because as I mentioned, I've reviewed this form for 16 years. I used to get a call from all over the country from different insurance divisions to ask me to send our statutes because they were a lot better than any of the states had statutes. Because of that experience, I feel the authority should be kept, sir, in the insurance division.
Thank you for your comments. And, Mr. Ariel, regarding not answering the questions now, but from what I heard from your testimony, that this is not actually going to lock us into the compact agreement. This is like taking the next step to show that we are interested, but we would not be at their back-end decisions. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. And if I can just say a brief word to what Bill said, I'm very proud of the work that Bill did for us, and I think in the health area where he worked, we do have some unique and different laws that are very important, and nobody's proposing a compact for health insurance because it is, as you know from a lot of different venues here in the legislature, much more of a state-by-state issue. But I believe that the compact for life and annuities is effectively protected on the kinds of questions he asks. And as you point out, before any standards would be adopted, we would be looking at the details of those standards for a particular product and the kind of questions that Bill's raising and the kinds of issues that he would have concern about would be fully vetted and fully addressed in those individual rulemaking procedures.
All right, thank you. Any questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2224?
Any questions, sir? May I leave?
Yeah, you may leave. Thank you very much.
Thank you very
much, Ms. Sandu. So I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2224. And is the committee ready to move on this one, or do we want to take some time to reflect on what's before us?
Like to take some time.
All right, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. We won't do a work session at this time on that bill, and we will go back in order.
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2401. And Anna, why don't you go ahead and do that? I'll let you off the hook on the other ones.
That's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2401B provides early retirement exception under the public employee retirement system for 911 operators. There is no amendment on this bill. There's no revenue impact, and there's a minimal fiscal impact, no statement issued. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We have four people that are currently signed up. I'm going to go ahead and do two panels of two. Brian, why don't you go ahead and come forward, and Kevin? Okay, then we'll do Mary, and Mary's not on here, but I've got Francine and Sally. Good thing we have three chairs. I'm going to have to call 911 to get some action.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin, and I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. I'm actually not even going to testify today. I'm just going to sit here with those folks who are going to testify, and I'll be ready to answer questions if you have any. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is in light of your time constraints.
We appreciate that. Thank you very much.
My name's...
Just take one of them, not both of them.
Okay.
I understand that we don't get stereo this way.
No stereo? Okay. My name's Francie LaMarche. I'm a member of the AFSCME Retirees Union, as well as a retired Clackamas County 911 dispatcher. 30 years of service, and I made it to January of 2006. I've been working on something in this form for recognition for dispatchers since 1991. The state has come along, and the profession has come along to where it is now a profession. It's not a clerical job. Our job has a lot of stress, and we have statistics that back up the fact that our work does need help. It needs help in the fact through recruiting and retention. This retirement bill will go a long ways to serve that. Generally speaking, on an average, dispatchers will burn out after about 7 years. 2% of the population are capable of doing the job. We have to find our employees, or the people that are still working, have to find their employees out of the 2% that are willing to work nights, weekends, and be away from their families. That leaves us with not a very large number. The success rate is not very good. In some places, it'll be down to 25-30%. Others are lucky, and they get up to 75%. The bigger agencies usually have the larger problem because they have a larger volume and a higher multitasking ability, and that is really really hard. You have a booklet in front of you that basically gives you the numbers as we see it here. There's approximately 1,000 DPSST certified telecommunicators in the state, so we're not talking about a large quantity of people. Very few retire with full benefits. And like I said, a lot of people burn out prior to that. There, it will improve recruitment. There's not a lot of states that have early retirement. That's going to make Oregon real popular. And when we're trying to get people into the job from any place, and even green people, that is going to be a huge draw and hopefully will give us a bigger piece of the 2%. Anyhow, like I said, the numbers are in here. The numbers that you're seeing is not for the whole state. They're for the larger centers and from kind of a smattering from across the state, so you can kind of see how the numbers lay. Do you have any questions?
Mr. Chair, let me just technically tell you how the bill will work. Technically, how the bill will work is that, and the reason there is no cost associated with the early retirement program is that the dispatchers will actually pay for the cost by taking reduced benefits through an actuarial reduction, by taking an early out. And so that's, it becomes cost neutral in that manner. We'd love to get them more than that, but at this point, they need to have a light sort of at the end of the tunnel.
Okay. Before we take any other questions, it's Ms. Jones. Why don't you go ahead and give us your testimony, and then we'll open up for everyone.
Chair Prezanski, members of the committee, my name is Sally Jones. I'm the administrator of Columbia 911 Communications District. I'm also a trustee on the Special District's Insurance Services Trust and co-chair of the APCA Legislative Committee. I'm testifying today in favor of House Bill 2401 on behalf of all three of those entities. I also have been involved in this field since 1973. I took a couple of years off to be involved in the Safety Belt initiative and campaign and then returned to this career. I worked for 15 years as a call taker, dispatcher, supervisor on the line, and for the last 16 years, I've been an administrator. I can tell you that what it takes to do this job where a person shares intimately the most traumatic moment of many people's lives, second by second, minute by minute, oftentimes juggling more than one call with that person at once, as well as making sure that the correct responders are going to the correct place with the correct equipment and the correct information, all while they are figuring out how to use the technology, the computers, and everything else. It takes a lot, and it takes about a year to train a person to be able to do the job. We also spend about 3 months screening people before we even hire them because we really want them to be successful. We try to figure out the best way that they learn individually, and we put them with the right people that love to train adults. We do everything we can to help them be successful, and we tell them that up front when we hire them. We want them to be a partner with us. Tell us how you best learn, and we'll figure out how to teach you that way. In spite of that, in our center, we actually have a higher rate of retention. About 75% of the people we hire, we keep. But our average longevity is only 8 years. So there's quite an expense involved in screening, recruiting, training, and retention. The other issue is that I also have a couple of people in my dispatch center that have worked in this field for about 20 years, one 22 and the other 20, and they're getting tired. They're getting really tired. They're good public servants. They never complain when the work needs to be done. They step up and do it. If there's overtime that is needed to fill in for a coworker that's sick or needs to go on vacation, they're there. If there's new technology or change in procedure or new workload added to them because we're consolidating and adding new districts with new procedures, they don't complain. They figure out how to make it happen. But these folks are getting tired. And as their administrator, I sure don't want to hand out discipline because they're doing things wrong, just because they're tired. They have a wonderful work ethic. They're incredible employees. And I think that they deserve to retire after 25 years of good service without penalty. And that's really why I'm here to testify. This doesn't exactly match my written testimony that you have before you, but I would be happy to answer any questions that you have.
Questions? Senator Beyer first.
Thank you. Probably directed at Mary. You say we have a shortage or potential shortage of 911 dispatchers, so we do this, people get out, and then are they going to be coming back and double-dipping?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, it has been our experience that when people leave this field, it's not likely that they will come back. I mean, they leave the field because they're burned out. And, no, they would not come back to double dip.
But they would be eligible to come back and work 1,040 hours a year.
1039.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they could. Part-time dispatchers don't, I mean...
Fill in for vacations and stuff like that, possibly,
yeah,
in the center.
Can I talk about
that? Yeah, you're more.
I have... In Clackamas County, our dispatch center, our premium number is between 40 and 44 people. I've worked there since 1986. I transferred in via West Linn in Oregon City. We have never been at full staffing. Never, ever. When I retired, they were at 19. Those people do an incredible job. They deserve your support. And sorry, I'm going to get real emotional. I was going to try to stay real neutral on this. Like I said, I've been doing this for 16 years. I went back 3 days after I quit to help fill in time. I'm done. I don't want to hear any more grandmas dying. I don't want to hear any more babies dying. I love the work and I love the people, but I can't do it anymore. I have people that retired about the same time I did, and they've gone back and helped some, but they're not helping anymore. And I've had others that have worked that have left because they needed to go. Like Sally says, they're tired. They're done. Yes, I'm young. I'm productive. I could be productive. I do help. I've helped them with training and things like that. But they need, after 25 years of listening to everybody's every day, listening to... They don't call you because they're happy and the Easter Bunny brought them a good basket. They're calling you because they have a tragedy in their lives. A burglary, an illness, a heart attack. The bad ones you'll carry forever. And I don't, like I said, I can't go there. And I'm sure I started with Sally.
I appreciate that. Any other questions? Ladies, thank you very much.
I don't feel like we were very responsive to Senator Beyer's concern.
I think we got an answer here. Thank you very much.
I have a question.
Senator Gordley.
Thank you. I'd just like to know how many are at 25 years or close to 25 years.
How many? You mean in the state? We don't have that number on the back.
No. Let me answer that.
Yeah, go ahead.
Chair Pazansky, Senator Gordley. There is a meeting of the 911 managers on a regular basis, and I can tell you among the 911 managers, I would say a fair estimate is probably 10% of the managers are between 25 and 30 years. But the dispatchers, the call
take... If someone could get back to me with a number,
sure,
that would be just helpful information.
We can find that.
Thank
I think
you.
That the call taker dispatcher number is lower than that, but
okay,
we'll find out.
Any other questions? Ladies, again, thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you.
Brian and Kevin are the only two I've got on the list.
Is there anyone else while they're coming up that wanted to give testimony on 2401?
For the record, Brian DeLashman representing the Oregon State Police Officers Association and also the Oregon Council of Police Associations, both of which have telecommunicators in their organizations. I'm not going to testify. I'm here just technically to answer any questions, and I'll let Kevin speak.
Thank you. For the record, Kevin Iverson. I'm also a member of the Oregon State Police Officers Association as well as a dispatcher at the Oregon State Police. I had this nice written testimony, but everybody else's sounded so off the cuff was better than mine, so I'm probably just going to wing it a little bit. My support of this is twofold. The stressors that we deal with, as well as has already been addressed, the retention levels we have. Our current staffing is at about 75% of our center. We would love to have another tool to help draw people in. People do not look at this field as a career anymore. In my experience, the people we have coming in these days look at it as a job, a stepping stone someplace else. We would like to have another tool to get those people in and make it a career, see if we can keep those people in here. The other issue is, everybody has already attested to, is the stress levels. There's no way to explain to people what the stress levels most of these people go through. There's no frame of reference that the normal person, short of having a tragedy in their life, they don't have that frame of reference. And when you deal with that on a day-in, day-out basis, there's really no broad studies being done so far on what the cumulative effect is on it. I can tell you I've been working this for 15 and a half years. In the last 10 years, we have turned over 52 people in our center. We have an average staffing of 27. Out of that time, we have had one person make it to full retirement. And it was absolutely time for her to go. She had no desire to come back and do this ever again. She left with a heavy heart and decided that was the end of it. We would like the opportunity to have people come in and look at this as a career, something they want to do for the rest of their time. Help us bring these people in and support this bill.
Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Gentlemen, thank you. And I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2401. And Representative, did you want to get that information before you voted on this?
No.
I'm going to go ahead and open a work session on House Bill 2401, and the chair will entertain a motion to the bill.
Mr. Chair, I would move 2401 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe moves House Bill 2401 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I guess if Paul Cleary, do you agree that just nod yes or no that the bill is revenue neutral as far or cost neutral, I should say?
Yes.
Any other discussion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I would just like to express appreciation for the folks who are on the other end of the line. If you have ever had occasion to call 911, you're just, you feel blessed that there's someone who's thoughtful and professional and who can help deal with some pretty stressful situations. I just think about my own personal experiences. So I'm just very grateful that we heard the testimony that we did today. And at some point, I would like to know how many are bumping up against that 25. Thank you.
All right. Any other comments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I'm going to support the bill. I have some concerns, but I guess we'll wait and see in the future if they play out. We've had to pass bills this session already on nurses training and DPSST trainees. And because there's shortages in the field, so we allow them to work more and double dip. And I'm afraid that next session, the session after, my fear is that we'll have a bill coming back saying that we have a shortage of 911 operators now because they've retired early, and we'd like them to be able to come back and work more than 1,040 hours in order to fill the void. And that's my concern, is just that we don't know enough about it. At least I don't, to know. So I'm going to vote for it, but I'm okay for my fears.
Fair enough. Go ahead and take a vote at this point. Is there anyone that an objection to the motion to move to the floor? It'll be a unanimous vote, so ordered. And I'm just going to make one comment. In my work as a prosecutor, and especially for the last 10-plus years working out of Florence, where there is a dispatch center, I've actually seen the individuals that work those jobs. It is extremely stressful from my perspective, even being someone that's trained in doing crisis intervention work, knowing what they have to deal with on the job and take home. And I will say from the 20-plus years I've got, I've not seen anyone who's retired out of this position to come back in. So I understand, and I think it's one of those things that we do need to monitor, and we will monitor to see if there's any, let's say, situations, as you've said, Senator Beyer, that comes up. But
My anecdotal position is I don't think we're going to see it. And with that, unless there's any other comments, I'll go ahead and close it. And we'll go ahead and close the work session on 2401, and I'll go ahead and carry this one. And we're going to open up a public hearing now on House Bill 2283.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2283A deletes the requirement that a member of the Oregon Investment Council be a member of the Public Employees Retirement Board, declares an emergency effective on passage. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And for 2283, we have, it looks like, two individuals, Paul Clary, if you'll come on up, Paul, and Kate Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS. This is a bill that was pre-filed at the request of the PERS board. I guess you could call it our recruitment and retention bill for our board members. Prior to reform, we used to have 12 members on the... Kate, can I get you to hand out?
Sure.
Get started there. We used to have 12 members on the PERS board, so it was pretty simple to divide up responsibilities and actually have someone assigned full-time to work in the Oregon Investment Council, paying less attention to the PERS board matters. After reform, we were reduced to a 5-member board, and these members are asked to spend 20-plus hours easily a month on PERS board matters, and it'll probably be at least that on the Oregon Investment Council as well. And all of them have a day job. So what we'd like to do is amend the current statute that mandates that the governor appoint someone from the PERS board to serve concurrently on the Oregon Investment Council, and instead make that discretionary should I find a member that wants to serve on both boards. It would be available for the governor to make that nomination, the Senate to consider it and confirm it, but remove that requirement that someone serve on both. I will tell you that I serve as an ex officio member of the OIC, so I'm at every Oregon Investment Council meeting. We also have written reports from the Oregon Investment Council on our investment performance and asset allocation at all monthly PERS board meetings. And Treasury staff regularly show up and report as well. So there is continuous interaction. We just went through two joint meetings of the PERS board and the OIC as well. So we think we've got the interaction that's necessary, and this, again, is something that I think will help us recruit people that want to serve but just don't have the time to spend 40 hours or so a month working on both the PERS board and the OIC.
Thank you. Kate?
For the record, Kate Cooper Richardson, Chief of Staff, the State Treasurer, and I'm just on here on behalf of the State Treasurer and the Oregon Investment Council to ask for support for this bill. I do echo Paul's comments here. We are a 5-member board. One of those members is the State Treasurer, so really our pool is down to just 4 members, and those need to be, as you'll see here in the bill before you, those need to be qualified by training or experience in the field of finance or investment. So that, again, narrows the field. So the crossover member, it can make it very daunting to look at both of these boards and the level of experience and time that it would require. And as Paul said, we work very hard to make sure there's a good amount of communication, and of course Paul being at every single meeting of the Investment Council too. So we're just asking for your support, and I'm here to answer any questions.
Questions? Thank you. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on 2283? If not, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2283, open a work session on 2283, and I'll take a motion from whoever would be so kind.
I would be happy to move House Bill 2283 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe moves House Bill 2283 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussions? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Monroe, will you carry this one?
And Senator Monroe will be our carrier. We'll close the House, the work session on House Bill 2283. And we're going to go ahead and open a work session, a public hearing on 2284.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2284A exempts public employees from a break in service determination under the public employees retirement system if they are subsequently reinstated after a successful challenge of a disciplinary or administrative action. There's no revenue impact. There is a fiscal statement that's been issued. There is an amendment, and actually I'm not sure who the amendment came from, so maybe we'll find out today.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Marianne, okay. So the mystery solved. All right, we've got I've got seven people that are signed up to give testimony on this, and I'm going to start with Jim Green. And Marianne, you've got a group that's of four, and I can't get four up at once. So Joe, why don't you come on up, and Paul, if you'll come back up.
And Mr. Chair, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I'm going to let Executive Director Paul Cleary start off, since it is an agency bill.
All right, so Paul leads off.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again, Paul Cleary, Executive Director of PERS. As Jim indicated, this was another pre-session filed bill of the PERS board. We worked with our advisory committee, which consists of both member and employer representatives, on this issue. I could sum it up, I guess, by just saying that it's our attempt to ensure that if someone is absent from employment because of some disciplinary administrative action, but then through a judgment, administrative order, arbitration, settlement, whatever, gets restored to that employment, they get restored in full standing, and in full standing in all aspects of their employer-employee relationship, which includes the pension benefits that are available to them. So right now, with our break in service statutory provisions, if it takes more than 6 months to resolve that matter, they're going to go into a break in service and not be restored to full standing, because they'll come back in our new plan, our OPSERP plan. So it just seemed to be something in the interest of fairness and equity. It made sense to our board, and it made sense to both the member and employer side of the advisory committee to advance this.
All right. Mr. Green.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Jim Green from the Oregon School Boards Association. Today, however, representing OSBA, the League of Oregon Cities Association, Oregon Counties and Special Districts Association, we have a PERS employer alliance that gets together to take position on bills. And as Paul Cleary has indicated to you, out of our 2003 reforms, we did a couple of things. One was the PERS board is required to put together a legislative advisory committee, which we all serve on. This bill came from that legislative advisory committee, with both the PERS coalition, the public employee union folks, and our folks saying this is a bill that needs to be done. And let me give you just a couple of cases that have come up where this has been a problem. We had two school districts where folks were discharged from their duties and brought suit against the school district. The school district ultimately lost those cases, saying they had been discharged improperly, either by the Employment Relations Board or by an arbitrator. And the order came back saying restore these folks to their original positions with all benefits. Because of the break in service change that you all did in the 2003 reforms to PERS, we couldn't comply with the order and were an actual violation of an administrative order, which we could be again taken back to court on, and PERS could be hauled into court. So our idea was to come in and say this would be an exception to the break in service. If the person has been discharged and then it's comes back and it's either issued by ERB, administrative agency, arbitrator, or settlement agreement, that they will be put back to full time, they'd be put back to full time. It just simply takes those ERB decisions and the arbitrator's decisions that were against the Lebanon School District and the Portland School District and allows us to implement them. As I think Mr. Cleary says, and Mary Bodkin will probably testify, this is simply an issue of fairness. And employers across the state recognize this and support this. We worked during the interim with both the PERS Coalition, which I think you're going to hear from next, and PERS staff to make sure that we got this right. The dash one amendment, or the dash A3 amendment, I believe, is coming from Marianne Guest. We've talked about that. We visited with that after the House, and we're also supportive of the dash A3, and I'll let them present the amendment, however.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mary Botkin, member of the PERS Coalition and the Labor, or the PERS Advisory, Legislative Advisory Board, whatever it is for PERS. And yes, Jim's absolutely right. We're here. We'll be supporting a much broader break in service change later, but on this one, we're together. And we think that this answers the problems that arise from successful resolutions through the collective bargaining agreements that don't necessarily meet the same letter of the law that's currently before you with break in service. So this solves our problem.
Thank you, Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so in plain language, what would this bill do for custodians who were fired illegally by Portland Public Schools?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gordley, I'll take a stab at that one. If they have come back to work with a PERS-covered employer, they would be restored to Tier 1 status. And I think the Dash A3 amendment also expands that to within a year of the order coming down. So for those custodians who were now found to be terminated wrongfully by the Portland Public School District, this bill, if they'd gone back to work for Portland Public or another PERS-covered employer, it would comply with the order that came down saying you need to reinstate them to their full status. It would make them Tier 1 or Tier 2, depending on which one they were. It would not put them into the break-in service and make them a member of the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, OPSERP, Tier 3, whatever you want to call it.
If I can just add to that, one of the important factors in that change is that OPSERP has an older retirement age, and so there got to be a real confusion about what age would you retire at, you know, under Tier 1 or Tier 2. And so this resolves that issue for those folks.
And I might add, Ms. Chair and Senator Gordley, for us it makes it a lot easier to administer. Right now everyone is in two different retirement programs. They're either Tier 1, Tier 2, or OPSERP for their pension, and then they've got their personal retirement account or individual retirement account, what we call the IAP. By taking care of this, we can ensure that at least for these people, we don't have them in three programs. Mm-hmm. And it's much easier for us to administer if we keep it to two.
Any other questions for anyone on this panel? All right, thank you very much. Marianne Guest, Tina, I believe it's Jackie, and Mason Young.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Marianne Guest representing the Oregon School Employees Association. The amendment was, as Jim Green mentioned, was only to add that if somebody is reinstated, and let's say they're not working for a PERS-covered employer, maybe they're working for a private sector or whatever, it gives them up to 1 year to go back and get PERS-covered employment. And so it just allows them, extends from the date of judgment to 1 year to allow them to go back into PERS-covered employment and also fall under the original PERS status that they were at. So it's not a complicated bill. It's not a complicated amendment. We are very supportive of House Bill 2284. I think people, through no fault of their own, to have them lose their retirement status is really unfortunate, and this bill will solve that problem. Thank you.
Thank you. Whoever wants to go next.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, my name is Mason Young. I was a 16-year civil service custodian with Portland Public Schools until my job was outsourced to a private contractor in the summer of 2002. I found work in December of 2003 with Beaverton School District, hired under the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan, not the PERS Tier 1, due to a 6-month break in service. October of 2005, Oregon Supreme Court ruled that myself and 300 Portland Public School civil service custodians were illegally terminated. Well, about 100 Portland Public School custodians accepted recall with the district in September 2006. I chose to stay with my current employer and have continued a secure and enjoyable custodial career. I ask you to restore my PERS Tier 1 status. Please support House Bill 2284A as amended by the amendment introduced by the Oregon School Employees Association. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair and the committee, my name is Mark Schnorr. I'm here to support House Bill 2284. I was an 18-year custodian with Portland Public Schools until the school district decided to break civil service law. And that is the strong thing for me, is that they broke the law and I didn't leave that job on my own free will. I was fired illegally. And this bill will make me and a lot of other people whole. I support the amendments because a lot of people don't feel comfortable returning to an employer that treated them that way. And it puts them in a position of, you know, like unfaithful employment. So with the amendments, I would hope that you would help push this bill through. Without them, I'm going to be stuck on a weaker retirement system. I'm 45 years old. I've been in physical labor all my life. I can't work 25, 30 more years under this new system. And I would just ask you for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for anyone on this panel? Senator Monroe.
I guess it's a comment. I was on the David Douglas School Board when this happened. David Douglas, as you may or may not know, has always opposed outsourcing its custodial staff. They're all employees of the district. I fought to keep it that way. When Portland Public Schools made this decision, I said publicly that I thought it was an egregious error, maybe illegal, but certainly stupid. And I will do all I can to help rectify what was one of the most abusive decisions I've ever seen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Do we know how many of the 300 custodians are returning to work at Portland Public Schools?
To date, approximately 130.
Go ahead.
Have returned. There's an out-of-court settlement that's being discussed that would open the door to allow some of the people that chose not to return earlier to possibly return, but that still hasn't gone through at this date.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you all very much for coming
Thank
forward.
You. Thank you.
Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony today on House Bill 2284?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the Commerce Committee. My name is Tina Jackie. I'm here to speak to you about House Bill 2284A. I've spent 15 of the last 19 years as a civil service custodian for Portland Public Schools. As a result, I was vested Tier 1 member of PERS. In July of 2002, myself, along with 318 other custodians, were illegally terminated. Due to the fact that I was out of the PERS system for over 4 years, when I returned to my former position with PPS in September of 2006, I was forced to return under the OPSERP retirement program. This is due to the 6-month break in service rule that was enacted shortly after my termination. I did not leave my position willingly, nor did I do anything to warrant a termination. All I'm asking for is to be made whole, and you, ladies and gentlemen, can do this by passing House Bill 2284A, as amended by OSCEA. Thank you.
Thank you. Joe, did you have any comments?
I just wanted to state on the record, my name is Joe Schaefer. I work for the Service Employees International Union, Local 503. This was, when I came on staff with the union, this was the very first thing that I worked on, and seeing a lot of these details of, like, the justice being brought back to these folks is really important to me personally. I really appreciated your comments, Senator Monroe. And I know that we can't undo the anguish that these folks all went through, but these little details make a big difference, especially when they look long-term towards their retirement and the rest of their lives. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Gordley, you asked a question about how many people have come back. 125 of us have returned. There is possibility of more that will return, but at this point, it is only 125, less than half.
Thank you very much. I'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2284 and open a work session on House Bill 2284. And we need a motion on the Dash 3 amendments.
So moved.
Senator Monroe moves the Dash 3 amendments in 2284. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
I'm just trying to figure out exactly that. I mean, it looks to me like the Dash 3 amendment gives an employee a year after an order. Is that the basic gist of it?
That's my understanding. From what I heard from the testimony is that by adopting this amendment, it will allow a person who was in that type of situation that may have moved into another gainful employment to be able to return back to their status that was terminated if they do so within 1 year with another PERS-covered employer.
But now the way I'm reading the bill without the amendment, they can go to another PERS-covered employer and they still get their service restored without having an amendment, as long as they've done it when the order becomes effective. Is that correct?
And that's how I was reading it, too.
So this is only affecting people who are working for a non-PERS person,
right?
And then if they choose to wait a year before they come back.
Right.
That's right.
In other words, if they've already taken employment, and then in these type of situations where they have been, let's say, cleared as to no, let's say, illegal termination, or they want to be reinstated back into the PERS or with a PERS employer, which they currently were not with, this would have taken care of that small group of people.
But the
I mean, that's the nods we're getting out there. So
the person we heard from that's working for Beaverton, he doesn't need the amendment. Person that if the person went right back to Portland public schools when they were called back, they don't need the amendment. This is for people, or if they're working for any other PERS employer, they don't need the amendment.
Right.
It's only people who have worked for
private or
non-PERS covered.
That's correct.
And have chose to wait up to a year before potentially coming back.
That's what I would agree. It's just within 1 year after, and that would be tied to the
I read that amendment.
I will oppose the amendment.
All right. Senator Beyer opposes. Anyone else wants to oppose? If not, then amendment does pass, and Chair will take a motion on the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair, I would move gladly House Bill 2284 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe moves House Bill 2284 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion?
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we're going to start with Senator Monroe, Gordley, and then Beyer.
Nothing we can do can restore the damage that's been done by the action of the Portland School Board back in 2002. Nothing we can do. We've disrupted people's lives. People have suffered great pain and anguish and economic hardship as a result of that action. But by doing this, we can at least give them an opportunity to have their pension rights restored.
Thank you, Senator Gordley.
Well, just speaking plain language, I think that asking or requiring custodians to join a retirement plan for new hires, well, that's just disrespectful. And it also pours salt on a still open wound. This is a time for healing. And, you know, hopefully this is a piece of that, a part of. This contributes to some of the healing. that a wrong was done, a terrible wrong.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to support the original bill. I don't know that I will support the amended bill now. And it's not necessarily this bill by itself, but I see five PERS tweaks on the agenda today. And 2003, we made some major reforms. Last session, the legislature came back and started tweaking. And in this session, the tweaking continues. And this bill made sense to me in its original form. If they got wrongfully terminated, they reinstated, and the judge said reinstate them where they were, we should do that. Well, we just tweaked it a little bit to give them an extra year to go do that reinstatement rather than going back at the time when the order is offered. That's why the PERS system gets in trouble, is the legislature cannot keep its hands off of it. Everyone always has a tweak. And after 20, 30, 40 years of tweaking, we have a system that's so complex that the PERS people can't even figure out how to run it, and they'll be coming back and asking for major reforms because the legislature's tweaked to death. That's the way we got to where we were in 2003, and that's where we're going down that road again. And I just, I say there's five on the agenda today. Each one by itself is not much, but when you start putting them all together, snowballs start as a single snowflake, and they continue to grow. And so I'm going to vote against the bill because of the amendment.
Thank you. Any other discussion? Any objection? Senator Monroe.
Just one thing, and I absolutely respect the good senator's comments, because we do need to be vigilant that we not undo some of the good work that's been done in PERS reform, restoring the system to credibility and so on. But this is an issue of fairness. We have people out there that were terminated illegally that may have taken a job that's not covered by PERS and that didn't know whether or not we were going to restore their pension benefits. Still don't know until this bill passes that their benefits might be restored. So this might, they might be watching what we're doing. They're in a job perhaps that's paying less, perhaps without any pension or without as good a pension benefits. And when we take this action, it may give them considerable incentive to want to go back to a PERS-covered job. And that, in effect, then finishes the restoration to the greatest ability we have, finishes the restoration of those employees from the evil that was done to them. I don't think we're talking about very many people. We can find that out before this bill comes to the floor. We'll need that number. How many people potentially could have are now working in a non-PERS covered job and would have the opportunity or option to go back to a PERS covered job from this group? I think it's a very, very few people. I think it's a matter of justice. And I would call upon my good friend, Senator Beyer, to reconsider his opposition.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess as a response, this bill is not only affecting what happened to Port Public School. This will become the law. And it's not only a retroactive bill, it's going forward also. So in the future, people will have that same 1 year. As I said, I was going to support the bill. This bill was not going to be amended because I agree it was a point of fairness to deal with something that wasn't anticipated in the PERS reforms of 2003. What happens if a break in service by no fault of the employee's own lasts more than 6 months? That's the bill would have fixed that. And the bill, I just believe, is an expansion now.
All right. Thank you. Senator Barr, I assume you want to be an objection on the motion. Any others? And it's not so. Motion passes. Senator Gordley, if you'll be so kind to carry the bill.
Yes.
I'll close the the work session on House Bill 2284. And we're now going to go ahead and open up a work session. And I've got 79, I think. House Bill 2279.
2679.
Did I say that wrong?
Yeah.
I did say that wrong.
Public hearing or work session?
Public hearing.
Public hearing on 2279.
2679.
2679, right? That's what I got written down here. That's what I got written down here.
That's what I got right here.
So it must be House Bill 2679.
Yeah, I wasn't wrong. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2679 allows member of the Oregon Public Service Retirement Plan to receive vested amounts from employee and employer accounts over a period that is equal to the anticipated lifespan of the member. There's no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I hope I am here on the right bill now. 2679.
House Bill 2679.
House Bill 2679. I'm Brian DeLashman. I'm here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and some other interested PERS Coalition members. What's being passed out to you, this is a very simple bill, but the easiest way for me to explain it and for everybody to vote yes on it is to understand the chart that I'm passing out.
The complex chart.
The complex chart here. On the next bill that I have, I'll hand out a chart as well. But prior to 2003, as you're all aware, the contribution by the employer and by the employee was combined and went into a PERS account. And then at retirement, they were able to pick a number of options, including payout over their entire lifetime. Post-2003, we split so that there was the PERS account, so the employer's contribution went into an established PERS account, and then that payout was a number of options, including lump sum or payout over a lifetime. But the 6% contribution by the employee, which was placed in the IEP, by statute was only allowed to be paid out in 5, 10, 15, or 20-year increments, not over a lifetime. So this bill would allow that, in fact, the employee contribution in the IEP, they could choose as a selection payout over a lifetime. Now, let me clarify. That's not an annuity. That's not a guaranteed payment. That means you have this much money in your account. Instead of splitting it up into 20 years of payments, you're going to get a smaller amount if, in fact, you're expected to live 32 and a half years. So same money, wider. Why do we need this? Well, if you turn it over, simple little chart. Especially for police and fire who have early retirement. If you have a firefighter or a police officer that retires at 50 or 52, and under the current scenario, they're expected to live to be 84, and they choose to start drawing their money, their IEP runs out before they, in fact, live out their life expectancy. So they're bearer as a part of the retirement at the tail end. The other thing that I want to mention to you is that the IRS, until they passed the Federal Pension Protection Act, which passed a couple of years ago, did not allow for a pension, an IEP, or an IRA, or any other pension like that, to be paid out prior to 59 and a half years of age without a 10% penalty. But the Pension Protection Act at the federal level says if, in fact, it's paid out over the lifetime or expected lifetime, there's no 10% penalty. So what we're attempting to do here is just give them the option of saying we want to take it out over the lifetime and then avoid a penalty if, in fact, you're 50, 52, 54 years of age. You can take it out over a lifetime, take that same amount, split it up over more years, avoid the IRS penalty, plus you don't leave yourself bare at the front end or the tail end. And I'll take any questions.
Questions? Senator Beyer.
Would the person be required to take it out as the same as what their other account is? So, for instance, if they take their regular PERS account as a lifetime, they would also have to take this as a lifetime or 20-year.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe it would be a separate payout. So you could, in fact, select one or the other, or you could take a lump sum on the one. They are really very separate accounts. Your PERS system is one, and then the IEP account is a separate account. That's an interesting question. I don't know. Maybe Paul could give you more of an administrative answer, but I didn't visualize that they would be linked, that you had to take both of them out over a lifetime.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Beyer, they're not linked in current statute, and this doesn't link them at all, so they continue to be discrete distributions. You might find that people will pull their IEP money at a greater rate, even though they've got this ability to pay for retiree pre-Medicare retiree health insurance, because as a system, we don't pay anything towards pre-Medicare retiree health insurance, and that's becoming more and more of a factor for people.
Thank you.
If the money, I mean, if the lifetime ends early, the money goes to their heirs, correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, beneficiaries.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, if they outlive their life expectancy, their money has ended. If they live two more or three more years past when the anticipated payout is, that money ends. It just gives them the option of trying to spread it out over their anticipated life expectancy.
But if they take the PERS part as a lifetime. It's truly a lifetime benefit.
It's an annuity.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, we annuitize that at the assumed earnings rate. Here, there is no guarantee. It fluctuates with the market. And so, as Brian indicated, you could outlive it or you could underlive it. If you outlive it, there's nothing there. If you underlive it, it will go to your beneficiaries.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? And was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on this particular bill, which is House Bill 2679? Close the public hearing on House Bill 2679. Open a work session on 2679.
Chairman, House Bill 2679 to the floor with a due pass
recommendation. Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2679 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, do you want to carry this one?
Or I can.
Yes.
All right.
Senator Beyer will carry House Bill 2679. We'll close that public that work session, and we are now going to move into public hearing on House Bill 2224.
We already did 2224.
Oh, we did. That's when we pulled out. Mm-hmm. That's right. I knew we saw that one before.
Senator Johnson is here.
2280.
Senator Johnson, which one are you on?
Mr. Chair, I'm here at 2585.
All right, we'll open a public hearing on 2585. Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2585A expands existing exemption for retired public employee retirement system members who are employed as teachers or administrators for education service districts with under 35,000 people without loss of public employment retirement system benefits. It declares emergency and it's effective on passage. There is an A2 and an A3 amendment, and I do have a little Panda Gross version if the committee would like that.
And there's also an A4.
Now an A4.
And there's an A4.
Yeah. And it is for that purpose, Mr. Chair, that I appear before you.
Okay.
Okay. Why don't we do this? I think before we go into A4, let's just get an overview. We've got the overview. Is there anything else, Mr. Green, that you want to put on the record before we have the
Mr. Chairman, no. I think your committee administrator has explained the bill. I can answer some questions about the bill, but I know Senator Johnson's time is very valuable, so I'd like to have her explain the A4 amendment.
Please.
Thank you. That should be in the lobbying 101 handbook.
I think it is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
And I think he gets a gold star for the day.
He did in my book, sir. For the record, my name is Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing Senate District 16 in the Oregon Senate, and it is because of that district that I am here advocating for the Dash 4 amendments, specifically on page 1 of the printed A engrossed bill. Insert the words or community college district. We have a community college in Tillamook, the smallest in the system, struggling to find leadership. We were delighted when the former president of Lynn Benton Community College was able to come to Tillamook on an interim basis to help facilitate the search, and it turned out after a national search, the board extended the opportunity to come and lead the college to Dr. Carnahan. And under his leadership, Tillamook was the only community college in this last election cycle able to pass a bond. There has been a new infusion of enthusiasm in the community, realizing the potential of the community college. However, we discovered, given his retirement from Lynn Benton, that he would be disqualified from service. And so this amendment brings to you the addition of a community college president in one of these small counties, less than 35,000 inhabitants, that would otherwise have a great deal of difficulty recruiting a capable pool of folks if any of them were retired PERS members. And so just the same way that we have given relief to school principals and superintendents, this would extend that same relief to community colleges, the presidents. The universe is 17 people. I mean, and once you reduce the under 35, I think it drops to 2.
All right. Questions for the senator? Senator Beyer, I had a feeling that might be a question.
Why don't you just have him unretire? If he wants to work, let him work.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, without going into all the details of his own personal file, which I do not know and probably should not be discussing in a public forum, we did have some discussions with PERS, and there are some intricacies in his situation that make it not possible. And I don't know what all those are, nor would I presume to guess in this forum.
Well, I can guess he's making more money on PERS than he would be working for you, so he doesn't want to unretire.
Any other questions for the good senator?
I would just say in closing, Mr. Chair, that I think this is a unique opportunity for a little community college that stepped up, passed its bond, is yearning for the kind of leadership that Dr. Carnahan would bring, and I hope the committee looks favorably on the dash for us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good job. All right, Mr. Green.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm here to talk about the A engrossed version of the bill as well as the A3 amendments, and I'm supportive also as well as the A4 amendments. And members of the committee, I know that this is an issue that has caused some concern with folks in the legislature because, as I think Senator Beyer would say, it's called double dipping. And, you know, honestly, I fought through those 2003 reforms. I was the person, I think I stepped out of the room when local governments were looking for somebody to lobby the changes. I stepped out to get a Diet Coke, and I got the short end of the straw. And I got all the ire of public employees in the state, my brother included, my wife included. I received death threats at home. So I'm very aware of what we did in 2003, trust me. And I carry around with me in my portfolio every day the PERS statutes, and the PERS employer contribution rates, because one of the things I'm charged with is being ever vigilant on the system for employers and taxpayers in the state to make sure we don't add cost to it. And while you may not agree with the idea of double dipping, and it's not really truly double dipping, an individual worked for a retirement for which they earned. Now they're coming back and working for a job for which they're going to earn a salary, and in every instance that I'm aware of, it has saved that public employer money, because they don't have to make a PERS contribution based on that person. And in most instances, the individual isn't working more than 1,039 hours, except in rare instances, and we've also worked out deals where we don't pay health insurance for the individual. So in all the instances that I'm aware of with my employers, it has actually saved money. Does it cause some concern because it makes bad press? Yes. Does it add cost to the system? I can unequivocally say to you no for PERS employers. And that's something I'm ever vigilant about, Senator Beyer, because I have to answer to my folks when we take a look at PERS increases along the lines of what we're still going to look at even after the 03 reforms. What House Bill 2585 does is it allows education service districts who may cover counties who have more than 35,000 and less than 35,000. We have a couple in the state. Umatilla Morrow, who brought the idea behind the original version of the bill, covers all of Eastern Oregon. The problem is the Umatilla-Moro ESD is centered in Pendleton, a county of more than 35,000. But they service seven or eight counties out in eastern Oregon whose employees never come to Pendleton, don't live in Pendleton, but service Grant County, Morrow County, Gillum County, Harney County. I mean, they drive thousands of miles. This original bill would allow those folks to work more than 1,039 hours if they'd retired from a PERS-covered position, because in those instances, it's hard to recruit people to rural eastern Oregon to do the jobs that they have to do. In most instances, they're providing the federally required services to students with special education needs. And I can tell you, it's hard to find folks to work out there. That's what the original version of House Bill 2585. The other ESD that I can think of that's in that same position is the South Coast ESD. Coos County, where the ESD is housed, has more than 35,000 inhabitants. Curry County does not. So it would help those two ESDs with shortages that they've seen. I think Senator Johnson explained to you the issue with the Tillamook Bay Community College. The A3 amendments deal with another shortage that we found in our state, and it deals with speech pathologists and speech pathologist assistants. And our problem with this is we have currently, in our school districts across the state, over 200 vacancies for speech pathologists, licensed speech pathologists, and the same number for speech pathologist assistants. These are folks who work with kids who are on special education plans, individual education plans. They are mandated services that are come through the student's IEP, their individual education program or plan. We have tried to work with our state system of higher education to get more licenses. Unfortunately, right now, with that shortage and working with our state system of higher education, we're only able to get 25 licensed individuals out of the program in a year. They had to deny 200 applicants last year to the program because of just capacity. Our ESDs have worked with another university outside of Oregon to come up with a plan to try to get these folks in, but we have a real shortage. And I don't know how many retired speech paths or speech path assistants there are in the state, but this will give us the ability to try to address the shortage in a short-term need. I've spoken with John McCulley, who represents the Oregon speech path pathologists. They're supportive of the bill. I've spoken to folks from the PERS Coalition, the Oregon Education Association, the Oregon School Employees Association. They're supportive of the bill. I've run the amendment by PERS. They don't see a problem with the amendment. And really, the problem may deal with the issue of double dipping. And Senator Beyer, I know that's a concern to you. It's a concern to everybody that has to pay taxes into the system and take a look at PERS costs. But I can say to you today, unequivocally, by allowing folks to do that, it does not cost the system money. And it does not cost PERS-covered employers any additional funds as well. In most instances, it actually saves money. And with regard to Senator Johnson's comment, Tillamook Bay, President Carnahan did that search. We did the search. The Oregon School Boards Association did. There were two national searches done for that presidency, and no one would take the job. At that time, that community college board looked around and said, well, geez, we got the best guy doing the search for us to do this job. Because of his situation, we need this amendment to allow him to continue to serve as that president. Without that, they will go on another national search where it is unlikely they'll get candidates, according to the office that I spoke to earlier that does our searches for us.
Thank you. Questions from Mr. Green?
I do have a question.
Got first Senator Beyer and then Senator Gordon.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jim, on the Dash 3 amendments, the speech pathologist issue I am pretty familiar with, but and I know that someplace in another bill there's, you know, somebody's working with an out-of-state college because Portland State and Oregon, University of Oregon don't seem to want to, I guess, graduate people or bring people into the program. But was there any other ways to look at this problem? To address it, and the first thing that came to my mind is why are we requiring mastered certified people to do these jobs? I mean, that's a TSPC issue, obviously not a PERS issue. But why are we requiring mastered certified people to do these jobs? Why don't we lower that requirement to people with bachelor's degrees?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, I can tell you as it relates to the shortage with speech paths, because we are working with the Nova Southeastern University, which is a distance learning program that our ESDs are trying to put together to get more license. We're looking at every issue within this shortage. But we have such a massive shortage of these folks right now. This is one small piece of the puzzle. And I can't say to you today that there is a retired speech path that wants to come back to work. But it may be an option, as I spoke to the ESDs around the state who are trying to get these folks to come back. It's one option that may be available to them. We're looking at everything, even the TSPC rules related to this, to try to get folks to get this shortage under control. Because, as I said before, it's a federally mandated service that has to be provided under a student's IEP, and we've got to have the proper licensed folks to do that. We're working on every avenue to do that. Part of the other problem we have with speech paths is they graduate the program, and then private companies can hire them for $90,000 a year. We can't offer that in our public school settings to these folks. So we are in direct competition with private entities out there that can pay twice what we can pay them. And we're trying to address it at every level, which is the new program you spoke with, where we're trying to work with this out-of-state university on a distance learning program. We're trying to work on a licensure piece. This piece for allowing retirees back in is just trying to address this massive shortage we've got, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I mean, we dealt with this issue, as I said earlier, and everyone in this committee did it, on for nurse instructors and DPSST trainers. We put a sunset on it. And I think, you know, in this arena, we should do the same thing. If we're going to look at this, at least at this amendment, we should put a sunset on it, because I'm hopeful it is a short-time shortage.
All right. Senator Gordley.
Just a couple of comments. I am aware from my previous service on education policy committees and also the Ways and Means Education Subcommittee that we have a shortage of speech pathologists, and we have a number of shortages in the education workforce. And we're also very challenged to keep the best and brightest administrators here in our state. The question I have is why no one would take the job in Senator Johnson's district. Was it salary?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman,
you had two finalists, right?
It had to deal with salary. It had to deal with benefits that were available and what the community college could afford. Remember, Tillamook Bay is one of our smallest community colleges in the state. As Senator Johnson said, they were also very successful in passing their bond to get their building. But I think it had to deal with the overall benefit package that was going to be offered. And thankfully, Senator Gordley, they were able to get somebody who was well-respected as a community college president, probably one of the best in the state, in John Carnahan, who had his tenure previously at Lynn Benton. And he's willing to step up to the plate and do this.
Mm-hmm. So our challenge is to look at how we can be flexible to keep the talent here.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, that's what we're trying to do.
Thank you.
Senator Monroe.
Yes, I agree with Senator Beyer that an appropriate sunset would be in order. I'd suggest maybe 8 years, 2015. I'm looking at Senator Beyer. What length of sunset do you think would be appropriate?
I can't remember what we did on the other two.
We did 8 years.
8 years.
I thought it was 8 years, yeah. Okay, can we have that amendment drafted and then hold this until then?
Is that the flavor of the committee? Just want to know before we do it because we are running short on time.
It's fine by me. I'm more concerned about why we can't attract people to our public education system than I am about this bill. And it seems to me like a more appropriate time is however long it takes for you to hire the one guy, because I haven't heard anything objective that makes me think that this has much of a broader application than that. But if what you're looking at is a sunset, I'd favor that.
Well, I think, Mr. Chair, I just want to clarify for Senator Vakian. I think the sunset that Senator Monroe and Senator Beyer are talking about deal with the speech pathology amendment, not with the community college one. Because I think the way that the amendment, that the A4 is now drafted, is so limited to the specific instance that we're dealing with right now. It's the speech pathology one that would have the sunset. And, Senator Prozanski, I would be fine with that. It would give us at least some limited tool that we could use to try to get at that shortage.
All right.
That's fine.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 2585 and ask Anna if you would please get an amendment that would make the portion of the bill that will deal with the speech pathologist to sunset in 8 years.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, did anybody speak to the A2s? Are they?
A2s will be absorbed by the A4s. I looked at them during the talk, and so they are exactly the same as the first four lines on the A4. So it looks to me that we'll be moving the A3 and A4, knowing that we're going to get another amendment that's probably going to modify the A3s.
And it would be appreciated by me if we could have those as separate amendments.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll keep the A4, and then what we need is an update of the A3s. And that will become, unless there's another one floating out there, more than likely the A5, so we'll be looking at A4s and A5s.
It's a very attractive relating to clause. I'd like to put something else in the bill if you didn't mind.
Well, that could be the A6s. All right, so I think we'll close the public hearing. And we're going to move into a public hearing on House Bill 2280. Ms. Ron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2288 removes the requirement that the Public Employees and Retirement Board perform a biennial review of retirement benefits provided to police officers and firefighters when they are part of an alternative retirement system. It allows Public Employees Retirement Board to determine their frequency of that review by rule. There is an A3 amendment, and I'm hoping Mr. DeLashmet is going to speak to the A3 amendment we received today. Thank you.
I also have, besides the two gentlemen that are here, I had a note from Maria Keltner. Why don't you go ahead and come on up? That we'll have all three up together. And
Let's see, we've got another fancy diagram that will be coming for the A3s.
It's late in the session, Mr. Chair.
I know.
We need diagrams.
So I'm not sure who should start, Brian, if you or if Paul should start.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, Paul Clary, Executive Director of PERS. This began as a PERS board-sponsored bill and still is. Again, one to try to simplify some of our administrative responsibilities. One of the changes that came about with PERS reform was to change what had been an open-ended requirement to review locally provided police and firefighter plans against the PERS covered plan and ensure that those local plans were providing benefits that were equal to or better than the PERS plan. Historically, we've had that provision in our statutes. It had always been kind of open-ended as to when those evaluations would be required. In 2003, I think people thought, well, maybe it'd be a good idea to require these every 2 years. We did one. They're not cheap, and both the employers and I believe the members thought, you know, it's really not necessary to have to do these every 2 years. Let's do them when the benefits change, either the benefits increase at the PERS level or the benefits decrease at the local government level, and you're just again testing these systems to ensure that they're providing equal to or better than benefits. It's since been amended, and I'll let Brian explain that amendment with one of his diagrams here.
For the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. As Mr. Cleary has indicated, in police and fire, which is the only place in public sector, there is the ability for an employer to have a non-PERS plan, but it has to be equal to or better. And there are 10 jurisdictions in the state. City of Springfield's one, I think Union County, Wallawa, a number of smaller counties. City of Forest Grove, City of Portland, Seaside, the Dalles, Morrow, Tillamook, Union, Wheeler, Mid-Columbia Fire and Rescue. The reason why the chart, again, is to just give you a little history. If you look at the historical side, Norm-PERS police and fire plan was to be equal to or better than Tier 1. There was only one plan, Tier 1. So when there was a comparison, in fact, you were comparing it to plan to plan. Then came Tier 2, and there was no change in the equal to or better statute. And what you were comparing then is a non-PERS plan to Tier 1 or Tier 2, and nobody really picked up that you now had potentially two comparisons. Well, then we complicate it with the new OPSERP, 2003, non-PERS, police and fire, equal to or better, and it's being interpreted now as equal to or better than OPSERP. So you have potentially employees that are at three different levels of non-PERS employees, and all of their plans are being compared to OPSERP, which is Tier 3. So how it works, if you look at the other side, you could have a 20-year police officer or a 20-year firefighter who, if they would have been in a PERS employee situation, would have been in Tier 1, but their benefits are being compared to OPSERP, which is a relatively new plan with lower benefits and higher age retirement, so forth. How it should work and how the amendments the bill came across from the House was, not only did we eliminate, as Mr. Cleary had indicated, the need for the biannual review, which does have an expense with it, and leaves it up to them to make the determination when the plans change, they need to do the comparison. But when they do a comparison, they need to be comparing apples to apples. So if you're a non-PERS employer and you have people that have been there that would have been in Tier 1, you have to compare that sector to PERS Tier 1. And if you have employees that would be in Tier 2, you're comparing that, and then you're comparing the OPSERP. So you got apples to apples all the way along, and you're not, in fact, comparing everyone to OPSERP, because that, in fact, is a disservice to those employees that have been there for a long period of time. Now let me explain the dash threes. The way the current system in PERS was, if a PERS employer, a non-PERS employer, did not meet the equal to or better, then they were forced
to in fact send their employees to PERS. So their plan is kaput, and they move them over to PERS. What we said in the bill, the way it came over, is they have 180 days to make the judgment after it's not comparable across those three categories. They can move them over. But PERS's response, and here's the kicker between what happened over there and what happened over here, PERS's response was, well, there's only one open PERS system at this point. That's OPSERT. So, in fact, if you were going to move a police officer who had been someplace else for 20 years because their employer did not meet the benefit level that they should be meeting, you, in fact, would be doing them a disservice by moving them into OPSERT, into Tier 3. So the Dash 3 amendments, instead of saying they're going to move them over, would just say you need to compare the way the bill came across, and if, in fact, that comparison comes back that they're not meeting the benefit level that they should be providing, then, in fact, the employer, the group of employees, has the ability to go to circuit court and make their case based upon the study, and that they can bring a class action circuit court suit that would compel compliance with the requirement of equal to or better across those lines. So it gets PERS all the way out of the situation in which they're going to have to place these new employees in OPSERP. It doesn't do damage to the employees by moving them from a plan that should be equal to maybe Tier 1 or Tier 2 down to OPSERP, and gets them all the way out of it, and still ensures that, in fact, there is compliance with equal to or better. And with that, I'll answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Before we take questions, Maria.
Thank you. I'm Maria Keltner, and I'm representing the Employers PERS Alliance, which is made up of cities, counties, schools, special districts, everyone that's involved in Equal to or Better Than, and additional PERS and represented employers. The amendments in the bill that came over from the House, as I testified on the House side, increase the complexity of the equal to or better than tests and increase the cost of doing equal to or better than tests. Instead of running one test against the local plan, the amendments would require that three tests potentially, assuming you had employees in this local entity that might have been in Tier 1 or Tier 2 or Tier 3, all three of them, you have to run the test three times, which increases the cost three times according to the actuary that runs the test, which is the PERS actuary. So the complexity and the cost are both increased by the amendments. However, on the House side, there was discussion and there was agreement. Chair Schaffler agreed. Brian DeLashmith at the table in the testimony stated that the test would only be run if the local plan was changed. The amendment doesn't say if the local plan is changed, then the local plan fails the test, then the local plan must comply with increased standards. It must be amended and improved. The other thing that the Dash A3 amendments change, which is a radical change from what was over on the House side, is that the option of the local equal to or better than entity of moving into PERS is eliminated. It says you change your plan, you pay to have the plan changed to meet the test. And not only that, it's not included the language in the understanding and agreement that was made on the House side, which was the test won't be run unless the local plan changes. The local plan changes their plan, and it no longer passes the test. It makes a little more sense that they would have to change their plan back so that it did pass the test. But this amendment, the Dash A3, goes way beyond that, and therefore we're opposed to the A3 amendment.
If I may respond, Mr. Chair, if you look at the language of the A3 as it begins under 3, and if you look at page 2, line 17, the kicker for when a plan comes under review is exactly the same as it was as it came over. In fact, the board sets through administrative rule that process for when that review occurs. And it has always been our intention that that would occur when there's a change in the plan. And as we talked in the House side, the likelihood of PERS increasing their benefit plan is somewhat remote. And The only time that I can think of, other than just maybe E. coli being administered, of a benefit actually going up. So in all likelihood, what you really are talking about is exactly the same as it came over from the House. If I may address the cost of the test, currently the test that's being required under the existing statute is they have to do a test every 2 years, no matter if no plans change. So they have an existing under statute requirement to do a test that costs them money if nothing's changed. We are willing to say if nothing changes, in fact, there is no test. But if you change your plan, you have to do that equation. And so we believe actually there is a cost savings, because if they don't change their plan and PERS doesn't change their plan, they're not required to do any additional testing. It's a savings of dollars.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Beyer.
Thank you. Under current law, you've been doing these tests every 2 years, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that law came into effect in 03. We've done them once since then. It used to be, I don't think they did a test when we passed Tier 2 because it was a reduced benefit, and since they figured everyone had passed the Tier 1 equal to or better, then there was no reason to compare it again. Again, it's not something that is necessary unless a plan changes. And that would certainly be how we'd operate it from a rule standpoint. We've got some cost estimates in here. You see that the current statutory requirement, it's about $8,000 to $12,000 per employer. But if you did that five times over a 10-year period as currently required, you're looking at $40,000 to $60,000. If you only have to do it once in that 10-year period or not at all, you know, obviously there's where the cost savings comes in, and we certainly aren't interested in requiring these tests unless there's been some change.
Well, I guess, Mr. Chair, not this is not a question, but if you did it somewhere prior to 96 when it was just Tier 1 and everything was okay then, and you did it and you've done it since 03, so you know now that all the plans in the state are equal or better to, I don't understand why we even needed the Dash 3 amendments, because it was the only, it's all, it was done prospectively and, you know, and retroactively and prospectively. So why did we need the Dash 1 amendments? And now I understand, if we already know that, I understand more the Dash 3, what's the remedy going to be? I can understand more the reason for that than the Dash 1 amendments as or as the engross bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I'll give my perception, and certainly Brian might have a different perspective, but when we did the comparisons in, I think, 05, we compared every plan to the OPSERP program, and OPSERP only, because that was the only place we can move new members of the system. And so that's a different bar. They all passed by quite a bit. I suspect that what Brian may be interested in is making sure that that freeboard doesn't get compressed anymore.
Exactly, Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer. We believe that any test that compares all employees to OPSERP, in fact, isn't even a valid equal to or better. And because the statute had never been changed post-2005, when the study came back in 2005 of these 10 jurisdictions, I think the lowest one was 139% of OPSERP. Well, that's not an accurate reflection, depending on the mix of your employees. If you had all OPSERP OPSERP eligible employees, non-PERS, that's a good plan. But if you had 10 people that would have been in Tier 1 and 2 people that would have been in Tier 2 and nobody in OPSERP, and you're only 139% of OPSERP, then in fact, what is that telling you? And so that's why we said, fine, don't do the study as the original bill. But if you are going to do a study, at least do the study so it's apples to apples. And so you're correct. The last study showed that everybody met the standard, but the standard was really an invalid standard. The standard was OPSERP, comparing everything to OPSERP rather than Tier 1 to Tier 1, Tier 2 to Tier 2, and OPSERP.
Mr. Chair, I understand that, but my point is you did a test somewhere prior to 96.
Right.
Okay. And at that point in time, I'm assuming these 10 entities all passed the test. Right. So you knew that all the Tier 1 people, or people eligible for Tier 1, were okay. Okay. So then there you may have had a small group of people, because Tier 2 wasn't very big in Tier 2s, but then OSPERP was okay.
Right.
So there may be a small group of people between 96 and 03 that weren't tested. But prior to that, you were okay. After that, you're okay.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I think maybe you're speaking to the amendment now, because what this does is say if you haven't adjusted your plan since prior to Tier 2 coming into effect, there's no reason for us to do a test, because you obviously are going to pass this test.
I'm speaking to the original bill. The original bill, before it ever got engrossed, made sense.
Okay.
I'm saying the engrossed bill doesn't make sense because you already had a test for Tier 1. Everybody was okay. So it doesn't matter what Tier 1 was, because everyone was okay in Tier 1. You had a test at Osper that everybody's okay.
Brian, before you speak, let's let Mary speak. She's in the queue.
Chair Fazansky and Senator Beyer, we are not as concerned about the bill if it is clear that the review would be done only if the local plan changed, for many of the reasons that you're mentioning. The comments that Brian just made, that he doesn't think the last test was valid, causes concern if this language is going to say at such times as may be established by the board, and it doesn't say what was agreed to over on the House and what I understood Brian also said he agreed to, which was it won't be reviewed unless the local plan is changed.
So I'll let the chair have a prerogative here. The prerogative is the bill in a position now that we can do this by rule, or do we need to do this by amendment as to clarifying that piece of?
Mr. Chair, I am more than willing to put on the record that it has always been our intent that the kicker here would be when the non-PERS employer's plan changed. Then that's the kicker, and that's the understanding that we all had. In relationship to Senator Beyer's question, the reason why you need to have the amendment as it came over is even though the PERS plans have continued to go down, there is nothing in statute that says that an employer of a non-PERS employer can't change their plan at any time. So you need to have those reviews at some point. And even though you did one historically farther back, and then you did one in post-2005, although we thought it wasn't a valid one, to go into the future to make sure that we're comparing to apples to apples, I think you, in fact, do need to have the bill the way it came over with this additional dash 3.
All right. I think we're fine with where we're at right now as to how the bill is. It sounds to me we need the A3s, and we've got on the record, and we can put on the record before. Senator Beyer, will that satisfy your concerns? And then my understanding, Paul, through rules, right, there would be something in the rules that would actually state how these employers should be or when they should be doing this comparison.
Mr. Chair, right. What we would do is we'd require these 10 employers to notify us of any plan change, and then that would trigger the test.
All right. Chair is satisfied with what we've got right now. Senator Monroe, and then Senator Beyer, I don't know if you had a follow-up or not.
No. I just want to make sure I understand. If we adopt the Dash 3 amendments and pass the bill and none of the plans change and you don't have another review like you did in 05, then, in effect, the Dash 3 amendments don't kick in.
Right.
Nothing happens.
But only when and if you have another review because a plan changed or something, then you would go back to doing the apples to apples and the comparing, depending on whether they kicked over in Tier 1, Tier 2, or whatever.
Right.
All right.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I understand it anyway.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you.
We'll close the public hearing on this is House Bill 2280, and we're opening up the work session on 2280, and the chair will take an amendment for the dash A3s.
So moved.
Senator Monroe moves the dash A3s to House Bill 2283. Any more discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And the chair will take a motion on the bill as it's been amended.
So moved.
Senator Monroe moves House Bill 2280 as amended by the A3s to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And do I have a volunteer for this one?
Yes, I'll volunteer.
Senator Monroe is so gracious to volunteer his services on House Bill 2280. We'll close the work session again.
Yeah.
And we have two bills we need to do for work session. And I'm going to go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2222. Ms. Braun, when you get to the right page,
sometimes
take your time.
Battles ensuing. You need to make another one.
I forgot my tab.
That's wrong. Sorry. Call this one here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2222 was the OSHA bill that we heard on May 7th, and it removes the requirements that the employer have a safety committee if they have 10 or more employees, and it allows the DCBS to make rules allowing alternative forms of safety committees. We had a discussion about the concern about the drafting of the bill, but there was no further amendment, and it's ready to move if the committee so chooses.
And do committee members remember this one?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2222 to the floor with due pass recommendations.
Senator Byer moves House Bill 2222 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Avakian, would you carry this one? And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2222. And we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2223.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I have the same problem with this one.
How about this one?
I'm sorry.
There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2223A2A it expands the definition of employer to include the successor employers for purposes of OSHA violations. We had the question about the possible retroactivity problem, and we have an amendment, the A2 amendment from Legislative Council that it seeks to deal with the problem, adding an emergency clause and saying that successor employers before this date wouldn't be counted, so only from the emergency clause forward. So that is supposed to solve that problem.
So I think, Senator Byer, if I remember correctly, you're the one that brought up the question. It seems to me that we will not have retro, but it will be for those employers from the date this goes into effect, which would be upon signing by the governor, if it is signed by the governor, if it's passed out of this committee and passed by the Senate.
Mr. Chair, that's the way I read. Then we have a letter from Ann Boss, Legislative Council.
Yeah.
On that issue. So I would move the dash A2 amendments in House Bill 2223.
Senator Byer moves the dash A2 amendments into House Bill 2223. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2223 is amended by the A2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Byer moves 2223 as amended by the A2s to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And let's see. Does anyone want to grab this one?
Sure.
Senator Gordley will take 2223. Thank you very much. Now, before we close, we were scheduled to have another 7:30 meeting on Wednesday. I'm happy to report we will not be meeting this Wednesday at 7:30. Instead, we'll be meeting at a regular time. Thank you all for staying with us, and we may have to do the same thing we did today, go a few minutes over. But then I think our next meeting and last meeting would be a week from this Wednesday, since Monday is a day off for in district, as they say. And so we're closed.